Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Megan Howard from CEDSA. So tell me a little bit about CEDSA.
Okay, so we refer to it as CEDSA. And it was founded in 2013 over to 2014 after my son Jacob had been diagnosed with ectodermal dysplasia. And I discovered at that time, I'd never heard about it, didn't know anything about the condition, started to do some research on my own, and was able to find an organization in the United States and an organization in the UK, both that got back to me very quickly with a lot of information, but there was nothing in Canada. So after doing some of my own work, we ended up applying for charitable status under the new Not-for-Profit Act. And now we provide support and a resource to other families across Canada.
So for those who might not be as familiar with the condition, can you describe it a little bit?
Yeah. So ectodermal dysplasia, there's actually 180 known types of the syndrome. And it impacts the hair, nails, teeth, and skin. It's a genetic, hereditary, though you can be the first person in your family to get it if you've got a mutated gene. And it results, there's a lot of different characteristics, but the overarching ones are usually inability to perspire, damaged or missing teeth, or they come in misshapen. They can't cry very well, or there's not very many tear ducts. They have a lot of ear and nose blockages or bad eczema, and anything basically that you can imagine that would make it difficult for your skin. It's very sore. They overheat very easily, and there's some of the syndromes that will also cause clefting of the hands and the feet.
So at present, are there any treatments available?
There aren't. And in Canada, there isn't even a systematic program for addressing ectodermal dysplasias. What happens is you get diagnosed, or you as a parent, tend to do the same thing as we did. You go out and you research and you find out something about it because you know there's something going on with your child. Usually the diagnosis comes from a dentist when your child teeth don't come in or they come in misshapen. And then from there, you end up building your own medical specialist team. So you end up getting referrals to specialist doctors, maxillofacial surgeons, dentists, dentures, and prosthodontists, and nutritionalists, because obviously with the teeth issues, you have trouble eating. And so at the end of the day, we all end up with our own little teams, and there's no connection. And most of the provinces don't have any funding to cover offset any of the expenses as well.
So it sounds like through your work, you've gone to the process of making sure there is that connection for those families out there.
Yeah, the goal of CEDSA was so that the next family, when they get that diagnosis, which is very scary, especially when you don't know anything about what it means for your child, if it's life-threatening, if it's developmental, any of those factors, and you obviously go on Google, we wanted something to come up right away to say, okay, there's information here, there's a Facebook page and a support group you can reach out to, and there's lots of information, and we will help you. And one of the things we're in the process of doing on our new website, which will be launched in the next few weeks, we'll have a resource of medical dentists and specialists and doctors and dermatologists, et cetera, that have given us permission to include their names on the directory who have had experience treating ectodermal dysplasia, because that's the biggest challenge. You're always teaching the medical profession when you walk in because they've never heard of it or never treated it. And it can be very frustrating for a parent and a little scary. So this way you're connecting with medical professionals that at least have some base knowledge about the syndrome.
So for those medical professionals that don't have as much knowledge, do you find they're typically receptive? I mean, we've all heard of those doctors who say, if I've never heard of it, it doesn't exist, sort of thing.
It's been hit and miss. So we've had some that are absolutely excellent. We're lucky enough in my family to live close to the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario. I've gone in there for emergencies when the doctors on call didn't know anything about it. And then we've had some of our local hospitals where, you know, if you have a visiting resident, sometimes you get one that their ego, unfortunately, seems to be more important than hearing from a parent about a disease they don't want to admit they don't know. I like to tell a story about the time a doctor came back into the room and he had a bunch of papers with him and he said, well, this is what I know about it. And I said, well, you just printed those off my website. So there can be some ego involved, but on the whole, as a family, we've had extremely good experiences, and the people that are treating Jacob now have gone out of their way to learn as much as they can, even though there's not a lot of information out there. They're sort of treating it as it comes, to do the best they can and to educate themselves and to connect with us to make sure that he receives the best quality of care.
So in your time with SEDSA, is there any success moment that really stands out for you?
Yes, there is. There was a young lady from Alberta that we connected with very early on who is a very brave girl. She refused to let it slow her down. She was a competitive dancer, which if you can imagine, not being able to perspire and overheating, and that's life-threatening, not letting that stop or compete in a competitive sport. And she reached out to us and said that she had some money set aside to fix her teeth, but not enough, and that I'd really like to be able to, you know, not take my teeth out, put them in a jar beside my bed at the end of the day. Beautiful girl. And so we were able to help her, and at the end of it, she wrote to us, and she said, you know, I have this wonderful smile because of SEDSA, and I have a boyfriend, and he's completely changed my life. So I think that was probably one of the biggest highlights for us.
So if you could send any message to the community about this condition and about the need for greater awareness, what would you say?
I would ask for coaches and teachers in particular, or anyone that's involved in the community and community efforts, if there is a child, or if they find there is a child in their community that has this condition, and it is rare, but you know, it's 1 in 20,000. It's not inconceivable that they would have somebody in their community, to make every effort to make that child be able to belong. And that includes, you know, making adjustments so that they can play in a sporting event or have an air conditioner in the classroom so they can go to school on a hot day. There's lots of things that as individuals they can do that would make that child's life and standard of living more normal.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes, I will. Thank you very much.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Paula Hearn and Sean Whitshire from DRPI Aware. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with DRPI Aware.
So this is Paula Hearn, the project coordinator for DRPI. So Disability Rights Promotion International, the Asian workplace approach that respects equality. We are in our fifth year of our project, operating out of Hyderabad, India, Kathmandu, Nepal, and Dhaka, Bangladesh. So in this time in the project, we are really focusing in on trying to increase more people with disabilities into employment positions, and also focusing more on our promotional and media and awareness pillar of our project. So we are using a bit of a different methodology in our project and our work to focus on the right to work. We were recently awarded the Zero Project Innovative Employment Practice 2017. And our approach is really focused on trying to change the mindset and of the workforce and the workplace, which is actually causing the disablement and the disability. So like I mentioned, one of the pillars of our project right now is really focusing on promoting awareness and trying to target stereotypes, stigmas, the discrimination that actually keeps people with disabilities out of the workforce and the labor market in these three countries. So recently, we launched some videos that have come out of India.
And it's been a longer process. It's that attitudinal change that some of the work that we're doing now. It is not only the videos that Paula referenced, but it's working with local employer champions in each of those countries to set up a network where an employer's group would come together and acknowledge the benefits of the diversity that they've been getting in their workplace and the value that it brings to them. So it's really much, much more than the video. It's those videos are sort of that other additional piece that you want to do to keep things top of mind so people are seeing change in a different way. You know, we had a meeting recently with an advertising agency in Bangladesh. And one of the things we talked to them about was, you have a lot of large clients that are from your country. One of the things we'd like is the next time you're doing an ad, put somebody with a disability in the background so that it becomes a normalization piece where seeing somebody who has different, you know, may get to work differently, or somebody who uses a piece of equipment that you wouldn't normally see. As that becomes normalized and people see it, it becomes less of a barrier and people don't think that much of it. So the videos and the other conversations and sort of making sure that the work that we have been supporting and doing in each of these countries supports the initiative of attitudinal change too. So it's, you know, we change attitudes by supporting somebody to get the job they've always wanted. And then they're making change on their own by doing the job well. And so those attitudinal changes are a little harder to calculate. So we're trying to introduce some more changes through the videos that have been produced in each country.
So how has the public responded so far to the videos and to the efforts to increase just disability presence?
So what we've seen so far is a very positive response. In April, we launched these two videos in, and Sridhar can tell you, our coordinator in India can tell you more, but we launched the videos at an employer event where the employers were intrigued by these catchy videos that captured your attention and kind of spoke to some of the underlying stigmas and stereotypes that people hold. And to really challenge people to think differently and to change that mindset. We've also launched them on social media and getting lots of attention, likes, and people sharing the video through Twitter and Facebook. So we're very enthusiastic about these different mediums that we're using through media. We've also been doing radio in the different countries. And we've also been doing different things like billboards in Hyderabad that, you know, capture a different audience. So it's still to be known because we're new in this area, but we're looking towards really engaging with people that we never thought we could actually reach.
So in this sense, is there any success moment that stands out for you of someone you've been able to reach or someone who's benefited by this work?
I think there's more than a couple of examples. There's in particular, there's the partnership with a pharmaceutical company in Nepal that hires individuals who have hearing impairment. And listening to him talk about the productivity, the owner of the company is just one example. We also have a really spectacular example in Hyderabad, India, with a company called Rockwell Freezers. The gentleman who owns this company started the company many, many years ago because his dad sold ice. And he really has a factory in a more rural area of outside of the city. But the factory is a family, and they include and have adapted the factory to include folks with disabilities. And he's even changed and looked at how his product line moves along production-wise so that he could include more individuals. So seeing those individuals in rural communities work at a factory that values them has been an enlightening and amazing opportunity to give those folks, the gentleman who owns Rockwell Freezer, some very good promotion and recognition that not only does he make a product that's green because his some of his freezers are solar powered, but he really has included the community around his factory and the people have taken ownership of the company, and they're doing very well. And it's a real inclusive environment. Not only is there folks with disabilities, there's women and a very large number who work on the factory floor. So sharing that workspace with men, women, folks with disabilities, he represents the future of employment in some places in India. So it's excellent.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Well, folks, I'm actually hoping to follow up with Sridhar Ganta in regards to what's been happening in India and the progress that's being made for people with disabilities. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The GATA Network is back in full swing with the annual GATA Academy happening on September 5th from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. in Dillon Hall. This series of interactive workshops is led by experienced professionals from different backgrounds across campus. The GAT Academy will feature resources and activities relevant to new and experienced GAs and TAs. Topics include classroom technology, creating and conducting effective labs and tutorials, best practices in grading and feedback, and so much more. To register, visit cleo.uwindsor.ca/workshops. That's Tuesday, September 5th, from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Get ready for the fall semester with the GATA Network.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Megan Howard from CEDSA and Sean Whitshire and Paula Hearn from Disability Rights Promotion International. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from David Lipovsky from the AODA Alliance.
Yep.
So, there was a recent article on the subject of delays about some of the accessibility work that Minister Nguyen promised. Can you elaborate a little on this?
Well, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act requires Ontario to become fully accessible by 2025 to people with disabilities. And when she was running to lead the Liberal Party back in 2012, Kathleen Nguyen commendably promised the coalition I lead, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance, she promised us that she'd ensure that Ontario is on schedule for full accessibility by 2025. Well, it's now halfway through 2017. We have under 7.5 years left to go, and we're not on schedule. We're behind schedule, and we're falling further behind. What led to the editorial in the Toronto Star recently is because over 2 years ago, I ended up having to file a Freedom of Information request with the Ontario government to get updated information on actions they're taking to implement and enforce the Disabilities Act, because we weren't getting a full picture from the government, and we wanted to see what was available. Well, the government responded by sending me a bill for $4,250, saying, if you want this information, you got to agree to pay this money, because the usual way the act works is it's a user pay thing, but they can waive that fee, and we asked them to. because the coalition I serve is nonprofit, nonpartisan, unincorporated, and has no money. Well, they gave us some information they said they could find, you know, without significant search time, but they did not. They insisted on the fee and would not agree to waive the fee, even though under the Freedom of Information laws they could. So I ended up having personally to appeal this fee to an independent agency, the Information and Privacy Commission. Now, fortunately, I'm a lawyer, so I know how to argue this stuff, but it takes a ton of work. Last January, the appeal was argued. The government sent fully 5 lawyers and a law student to oppose me. I mean, if they're worried about saving money, they're sure not worrying about saving money for the public if they're sending 5 lawyers. And we just got the ruling, and I didn't win everything, but I won a whole lot. The first thing is the government was found, the independent tribunal found that the government's fee, $4,250, wasn't justified. In fact, the tribunal knocked it down to $750. In other words, they've overcharged me by a factor of over 5 times. Let me put it another way. They sent 5 lawyers to battle me, and yet they couldn't even justify their own fee. In fact, they couldn't even justify 20% of the fee. This is like what have they got against us that they're putting up this huge barrier? So then the tribunal went further and found that, on the one hand, I had done a number of things to try to save the government time and money and offering to help. And the government, on the other hand, in a number of respects, didn't take me up on the offers when they could have, and it could have saved the money. So they faulted the government, and they also found that the government didn't really put forward the kind of evidence that would be needed to justify this fee, which is their obligation. So then the question goes, should they waive the fee? And under the Freedom of Information Act, the government should waive a fee if it's fair and equitable to do so, having regard to various considerations, including if the fee would be a financial hardship and if disseminating the information, making it public, would help promote public health and safety. Well, the government opposed me on both those points. They said it wouldn't be a financial hardship to us, and they said that this was not an issue of public health and safety. And the Information Privacy Commission rejected both of those arguments of the government. They found that the fee would be a financial hardship. They found that we have no money, we have no funds, we have no bank account, which is what we've been saying all along. And the government admitted that on the eve of the hearing, though they had not admitted it for 18 months up leading up to it. And the independent tribunal, the Information Privacy Commission, also found that disseminating parts of the information I requested would promote public health and safety. So the government, lost again on these major points. Now, the frustrating thing for me is the tribunal didn't end up ordering the government to waive the fee, even though it made these 2 powerful rulings against the government. And I find that frustrating. But nevertheless, we've asked the government to take this to heart, to go back and just waive the fee and give us the information. And here's the most important thing out of all this. The way the Freedom of Information Act works is if a member of the public asks for information, the first thing the government is supposed to do is estimate the cost of finding the information, of searching for it, and then send you a fee estimate. And if you agree to pay it, then they'll do the search, or they can waive the fee, of course. But if you don't agree to pay it and they won't waive the fee, they don't do the search, so they save the taxpayer the cost of public servants going out and looking for this stuff. So, and that makes sense. But what I found out just before the hearing was when they sent me the fee estimate back a year and a half ago, they didn't just estimate the search time. They went and did the search. They got public servants out going and looking for all the documents we asked for. And they knew that I had told them that we were not in a position to pay. So they knew when they spent the time looking for these documents that they were expending these public resources to find them, even though they had no commitment and could not reasonably expect a commitment from me that we would pay for it. And they knew we would ask for a fee waiver, and they ended up refusing the fee waiver. So what does this all mean? It means They've got the documents. They've been sitting in one place or whatever, one file or a computer file. They've got them all assembled. They've had them for a year and a half, and they won't turn them over.
So what information would you consider critical for the AODA to have from this?
I'll tell you the most critical one. Fortunately, they were ordered to turn over. Okay, the adjudicator decided that there is no search time that's justified and they should turn it over. We've asked them for their plans for enforcing the Act. There's been a lot of criticism, and properly so, that they're doing a poor job of enforcing it. The day before I filed my Freedom of Information request, the day before was June 3rd, 2015. And on that day, the government had a huge publicly funded celebration of the 10-year anniversary of the Disabilities Act. And as part of that, they made a big announcement of their plans. And one of the part of the announcement was they're going to start cracking down on violators. So the next day, June 4th, my request included, hey, what are your new plans for enforcement? Can we see them, please? And they sent us this bill for that, among other information. Well, in this ruling, the Information Privacy Commission has ordered them to turn that over to me. They can see if there's any exemptions under the Act, but until if there aren't, they're supposed to turn them over. And I should tell you, in 2013, they did turn over earlier versions of their enforcement plans and didn't claim any exemptions. So I don't know how there could be any now when there weren't any back then. And that's really important. We want to know what actually they were announcing when they did this big announcement back 2 years ago. And in the past 2 years, we have not been able to find the details of that plan. They would not tell us, and they wouldn't give it to us unless we pay. Well, now they've been told they can't charge us a dime, turn it over. And so that's the single most. But let me give you an example of the kind of stuff they're holding back. The previous minister responsible for this was a guy named Brad Duguid. And I had told, and the tribunal knows this, I had told his office, if he makes any speeches on accessibility, could they send them to me? We'd like to publicize them, send them out to the thousands of people on our list, and the people who follow us on Twitter and so on. And usually cabinet ministers like getting publicity for their speeches. And Minister Duguid, speaking for the government, had said that, you know, to defend their failure to do an effective job of enforcement, they want to educate people on their obligations. So we were one, oh, okay, what are you doing about it? And one of the things is the minister's own speeches, because, like, let's see what he's doing. Well, they're setting us a bill for the time to find the minister's speeches on point. Well, we told them in advance that we would like to see them. I don't know any cabinet minister that doesn't want their speeches publicized. But nevertheless, we're still being expected to pay some money to get those speeches.
I'm sorry to cut this short, but we're just about out of time here.
Let me just tell people, if they want to learn more about this, I'm going to give you two suggestions. Get email updates from us. Send a request to this at the following email address and just say, sign me up. The address is aodafeedback@gmail.com. That's aodafeedback@gmail.com. Or follow us on Twitter. It's @AODA Alliance. No dot, just @AODA Alliance.
Thank you very much for taking the time out. My friends, let me just close by saying I find it utterly ridiculous that a man would be subjected to so many hoops and so much red tape just to get information that should be freely available to anybody. The government made its promise to increase accessibility. Now it's their responsibility to follow through. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.